All right, I call this meeting of the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee to order. We are meeting under House Rule 10.01 that allows us to meet remotely. We will start with the roll call. Anna, please go ahead.
Chair Becker Finn.
Present.
Representative Mueller.
Present.
Representative Scott.
Present.
Representative Feist.
Present.
Representative Frazier.
Present.
Representative Grossel.
Present.
Representative Herr.
Present.
Representative Hollins.
Present.
Representative Johnson. Representative Liebling. Representative Long. Representative Mortensen.
Present.
Representative Novotny.
Present.
Representative Farr.
Present.
Representative Robbins. Representative Fang.
Present.
Representative Zhang.
Present.
I do see that Representative Long did sign in during the roll. So we do have a quorum present. First order of business will be approving the minutes for February 11th, 2021. Representative Long, do I have a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Long. Any discussion to the minutes? All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Aye. All right, the minutes are approved for February 11th, 2021. So today we're going to start with a budget presentation from the public defenders, and then we do have a couple bills on the agenda. So we will get right to it. So we have the Minnesota Public Defense Board here. This is their second time visiting us, but this time they're going to be going over their budget request. And I also asked that a couple of practicing public defenders share some testimony with us as well this morning, so we know why their budget request is important. So with that, I will turn it over to the Public Defense Board. If you want to introduce, I'm not sure who's going first, so go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony. Kevin, you need to unmute. There you go.
Oh, can you hear me now?
There yep, we go. Looks good.
All right, Madam Chair and members, my name is Kevin Kyer. I'm the Chief Administrator with the Board of Public Defense. Also on is Bill Ward, our State Public Defender. Bethany O'Neill, our Assistant Public Defender in the 2nd Judicial District. And Diana Sweeney, Assistant Public Defender in the 9th Judicial District. Thank you again for the opportunity, Madam Chair. Just as a kind of a quick review, if we can, is and some of this you saw when we did our overview, we are the largest user of the court system. The board provides mandated services in every county and in every courthouse, both on the trial level and on the appellate level. We talked about in our last overview the two big cases in terms of the decisions where public defenders cannot refuse cases. On the budget side, we talked briefly about this in the overview. Roughly 90% of the budget is personnel. Another 6% is what we call of our mandated costs. Those are things that are either contractually obligated, contractually obligated where we have a collective bargaining agreement, those kinds of things. The budget for this year is right around $101 million. The budget request for the next biennium, and just to give a little bit of a background, we put this together, the board did last August and September, when you all were facing some pretty significant budget problems. Not that you're still not facing some of those, but at the time you were facing a $2.5 billion budget for this biennium and a $4.6 billion deficit for next biennium. there was a need that we thought to be prudent, to be not only responsible, but also then to present what the needs are, but what can be accomplished as well in a situation where you all are facing some real budget difficulties. We understand also that this is part of a larger budget and a larger context in the COVID-19 era. So this really was a budget of maintaining public defense. There's a staffing component for additional support staff, salary and insurance cost increases, some one-time money for the caseload backup, which the court has talked to you about and we talked about, and then a like amount for our four public defense corporations. On the staffing side, or the staffing component, the board is now operating with about 75% of the attorney staff that state and national standards say we should. We are operating with approximately 60% of the support staff that those same standards dictate. We purposely did not ask for support staff or for attorney staff this time around, just because we didn't know where the COVID situation was going to go. We don't know what the charging practices are going to be. As you heard in the last couple of weeks, the jail populations have been reduced significantly over the last several months. The board purposely decided not to ask for those until we get to the other side and see where all this is going to take us. Those of you, I must say about just a word about the standards. Those standards were developed in the 1990s. Those of you who practice know that the practice of law has gotten much more difficult, much more complicated in the last 20 years than any of us could have imagined. Technology obviously is a big one, but chemical dependency issues, mental health issues, the use of audio and video, forensics. We went through some of those in our overview a few weeks ago. So the proposal would be to bring our support staff levels up to the level of where our attorney levels are. And that's the difference that you see here on the green versus the blue column on the support staff. Just to give you a little bit of an idea of what that would do, you can see the far right column is where we're proposing the number of attorneys per support staff. The second column in from the right is where we are now. Again, those of you who practice privately, those of you, frankly, who are in some other public entity, let's say prosecution, county prosecution or city prosecution, you can see these numbers are not outrageous by any stretch of the imagination, and we're still very much understaffed. I believe it was Representative Liebling who had asked the question when we were doing our overview of whether or not there were standards in place in terms of staffing, and we do in fact have those weighted caseload standards that I mentioned. Just to give you an idea of the request versus kind of where we would be in a perfect world of being able to achieve the caseload standards. It's about 289 staff people and a cost of about $28 million. So again, there are standards. We would love to be able to meet them, but we also are realistic in that you all don't have that kind of money to be able to do that. So.
And Mr. Kier, I will ask you to clarify. So if we were to actually fully meet those standards, what would the cost be to fully serve Minnesotans?
Madam Chair, the first year cost, the first full year cost, obviously you won't be able to hire everybody at the same time, but the first full year cost would be 28.6 million.
Okay, on top of the,
top of the current base budget, yes.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Kier. Please go ahead.
Madam Chair, the second component is the asking for the one-time money for temporary help to get us through the backlog of cases. I know that the courts have talked to you about this. We talked with you a little bit about it when we were in front of you a couple of weeks ago. As of the end of July, there were 10,000 felony and gross misdemeanor cases that were pending. We just don't have the bodies to be able to address that kind of a backlog. The courts will be hiring and have hired retired judges to sit in to handle the regular calendars, if you will, and have the current judges do the contested hearings and the trials. We just, again, don't physically have the bodies to be able to do that. So we're asking for some one-time money. We're estimating that right now, based on the backlog, is about 46,000 hours of attorney time. And how we came to that was we looked at what the court was projecting back in July in terms of judge need and the number of hours, and we added an hour of out-of-court time for each of those hours, and came up with this, with the number of hours. The next piece, Madam Chair, is salary and insurance increases. We are asking for the funding for progression increases for all of our staff, as well as a cost of living adjustment of 1% each year of the biennium. Again, this goes to a couple of the issues that we talked about last time around in the budget, but also in our overview is we continue to have issues recruiting and retaining qualified staff. And the salaries are lower than other public entities. And then we'll show that in a minute. The other piece of this is obviously the mandated employee insurance costs. Those are MMB projections, and I know that you're going to hear, if you haven't heard already from the other agencies, they're all struggling with the same issues. Just a word about our retention and our recruitment. This chart shows our resignations over the last four calendar years. It does not include appointment to judgeships, doesn't include retirements. This is strictly assistant public defenders who have resigned over the last 4 years. That's the blue bars that you see there. The green bars indicate where somebody has gone to another public agency. Might be prosecution, either a city or a county. A couple of them actually came to work for you all in the legislature, some of them to the other state agencies. So about a third of the people that are assistant public defenders that resign end up going to another public agency. And those are the ones we know about. You know, we don't always know when someone resigns, you know, where they're taking another job, particularly if they're moving out of state, which we've had a number of folks do. So. So you can see that resignation rate now in 2020 obviously is a kind of an unusual year with COVID, but that resignation rate has remained pretty stable. So we're struggling a little bit with that. Just as an indication, Madam Chair and members, is if you look at the entry level and the top of the salary range for assistant county attorneys and assistant public defenders. This is in the 10 most populous counties in the state. So we took the average of all of those. That's where about 67% of the cases are. I didn't include, I think the number 11 was Scott County, which would have raised everything to the 70% level. But this is the top 10 most populous counties. As you can see, compared to where we were actually a couple of years ago, we've actually made some progress on the entry level. But we are still fairly far behind in terms of the top of the salary range. The other area where we're struggling is it does take longer for our folks to progress through the salary range as opposed to a number of these counties. I wouldn't say all of them, but certainly a number of them. How this impacts services is this. This chart shows our assistant public defender resignations by years of service. So you can see it's anywhere from 3 to just over 5 years. So the struggle that we have is we're hiring good people, we're attracting some candidates, but we get them in, we train them, they start doing very well at their job, and then they leave us. And so we're losing a lot of that institutional knowledge, we're losing a lot of that training, we're losing a lot of that expertise where people can handle more cases, where they can handle more complicated cases. So that continues to be our struggle in terms of retention. In terms of recruitment, I will tell you we do not have a tough time recruiting in the metropolitan area. But we do have a significant problem when we get outside the metro area. We had 11 attorney openings that we just started advertising for right before the first of the year. We had a hiring freeze from March through January, or March through December, I should say. We had 11 attorney openings in the 7th, 8th, and 9th judicial districts. That's that portion of the map you see that are colored in orange. So, from a geography standpoint, it's probably half of the state. We only had 33 individual applications. We had a 75% time position in Bemidji and another one in Wilmer, where we only got 2 applications from people. We had a full-time position in Moorhead where we had 10 applicants, but only 3 of them were actually qualified for the position. So we continue to struggle with our recruitment in greater Minnesota. And Chair, the last portion of the budget request is a 4.5% increase each year for our public defense corporations. There are 4 of the corporations. These folks handle cases that would otherwise be public defender cases. The 4.5% represents approximately the same amount or percentage that we're asking for in the other part of the budget. And so that grant money or that with the board administrates that under 611.215. So again, typically in a year, those corporations will handle probably 4,000 cases a year. It's a little lower this year, obviously, with the COVID situation. So it's usually between 3,000 and 4,000 cases. Madam Chair and members, a couple of things that just to kind of put on your radar screen, we're not asking for money for them this year, but there's certainly things you are going to be hearing about. One is salary compression. Even if we wanted to and you all had the money to do it, to raise those salaries, statutorily, we have a salary compression issue. The state public defender salary is set in statute. And you can see our chief public defender salary range, our managing attorney salary range are bumping up against those. And our assistant public defender salary range is beginning to bump up against our managing attorney salary range as well. The other one, which we did talk a little bit about a couple of weeks ago, is this notion of the use of audio and video. Again, we're not asking for the money for this biennium or for next biennium, but you can see down in the bottom there, we have about an $850,000 cost over the next 3 years for audio and video retention. And that assumes that we're phasing in. Right now, we've only got a couple of counties that are doing that. We have quite a few more that are lined up to start. So that's only just phasing it in. Once we get all 87, or I presume all 87 at some point, this is going to be a major, major issue for us going forward. So, and Chair, that's it in terms of the budget request. You had the, obviously the breakdown of it. We'd be happy to stand for questions, or if you want to hear from our other folks first, whatever obviously you'd like to do.
Yep, thank you, Mr. Kier. We will go to hearing from some actual public defenders next. And one thing I'm going to ask you for, Mr. Kier, is to get us the actual number of what it would cost to properly serve the people of Minnesota. I understand that you may feel constrained by current budget situations, but our budgets are, you know, how we express our values, and we certainly could decide as a body to fill on this if we chose to. So if you could get that information to Ms. Ghanani to share with the rest of the committee, that would be very helpful. So the first, I have Diana Sweeney on the list. If you could introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Hello, Madam Chair. My name is Diana Sweeney. I've been a public defender now for 31 years. I've practiced for 25 years in Bemidji, Minnesota, in the 9th Judicial District, that rural area that Mr. Kier showed you. I'm also currently working on felony caseload and have been doing that for a while. My caseload currently involves three second-degree murder defenses. I'm part of the DNA forensic team, and that's a public defender group that comes together. We do training and assist other attorneys in the scientific challenge of facing DNA and forensic evidence. It's increasingly more a part of our cases and something that expertise is required, and we assist other attorneys who are available to do that, and that's above and beyond the caseload assignments that we have regularly. Should I go on into my presentation beyond my introduction?
Yes, please. Yep. And okay. We've just got a couple minutes per testifier. So please go ahead. Yeah.
Thank you. Madam Chair and the committee, I just would like to illuminate three areas. The DNA work is very important. It involves keeping up with an ever-changing science. Statistical analysis is currently a big issue, both in the forensic science world and in the courtroom. That takes time. It takes time to train. It takes time to meet as a group and plan our litigation strategies. And it takes time to assist the attorneys both in understanding their evidence and making presentations in court and challenging or cross-examining experts on the stand. The second area I'd like to address with you is that in working in the 9th Judicial District, currently our staffing is 20% below our normal number of staff attorneys. So we are all carrying greater caseloads than we would normally desire. And this is, as was explained before, due to retirements and leaving for other positions. I urge you to consider supporting salaries that help us recruit and retain talented attorneys. And the third issue I'd like to address is the crushing amount of work we have when the courts open up. When the courts were shut down for trials, because of course we're open and doing business, but we're not doing trials because you can't constitutionally do a trial, we believe, over Zoom. So to have that in-person social distance courtroom has increased the amount of time it takes to try a case. And because we've had delays in starting trials, we have a backlog of cases that need to be tried once the courts open up. So when a trial maybe would typically take a day and a half or 2 days, just social distance jury selection takes 2 days now because we call the jurors in one at a time for every case, even a misdemeanor DUI. And so picking a jury for a felony case can take 2 days. And our typical trial time when we were open for trials in Bemidji between July and November, trials were taking 4 to 5 days, even very simple matters. So for a complicated case, of course, it's going to be even more. The way the courts have been dealing with that is to just schedule trials back to back to back to back. So the seven attorneys who are staffing the Bemidji courthouse for trials have to be on call for trial all the time when the courts open up. That's going to be their plan. That's what we experienced the last time the courts opened up. That means that we're not in court covering our regular appearances with all our other trial, you know, our other court appearances. So then our colleagues have to, you know, cover for us and get support there. So it's just a strain on everybody. And we're not complaining that it isn't an important thing to get our cases tried, to have our clients actually get to that constitutional right. But the manpower needed to staff those trials nonstop is what we experienced before, all of us being on call to be up next, depending upon how things went, is a very daunting project that we're preparing for. So that's what I'd like to share with all of you, and thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Sweeney. We'll move to the next testifier. I have Bethany O'Neill.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair.
My name is Bethany. And please go ahead, just introduce yourself with your name and your title, and then go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Bethany O'Neill. I'm currently at assigned to felonies in the 2nd Judicial District, which is in Ramsey County. I've been a public defender, a criminal defense lawyer since 1996. I've worked in both the 10th District and the 2nd District in Minnesota. I also have done contract work with the appellate office. I was a state public defender in Ohio, and I've also been a public defender in the California state and federal systems. So I've had a career-long stint largely with public defense. I have three things I'd like to just talk about today. The first one is the difficulties of communicating with our clients and the changes since the pandemic has hit, as you know, and the importance of legal assistance and dispositional advisors to our work. What we used to do would rely on the court. The court would provide copies of disclosures to our clients, copies of the complaints, phone numbers, instructions for how to get in contact with probation officers for pre-sentence investigation reports, providing copies of pre-sentence reports, and contact information for release agencies pre-trial. Unfortunately, during the pandemic, the court has not done any of those things and have relied on our office and the attorneys in our office to do all these things, to provide copies of things to our clients, to mail them to our clients, since we're not in the same place. So the court has kind of shifted responsibility to the attorneys representing their clients and expects that we'll step into that role. And that is something that if we had more legal assistance, we would be able to help have them help us with that. Unfortunately, our legal assistants are spending most of their time opening and closing files because they have so many lawyers, they can't possibly provide that service as well. As Mr. Kyer also mentioned, there's the complicated nature of our cases. All of my cases have audio and video, that I am required to download from various systems and then to review. And that takes a lot of time. And that has to happen whether your client is going to resolve their case immediately or whether we're going to trial. That takes time to download and upload and then to review and catalog all of those videos. An average case would have up to 10 videos, just an average DWI would have up to 10 videos, but a more complicated case will have, I have one client who has 180 videos, all of which I have to spend my time downloading and hope that our system, electronic system, can handle it. One at a time, they're produced one at a time, and then make sure that I know what's on each one. Second, I would just like to comment that all of our clients, and I think this has really changed, all of our clients, or 90% of our clients, are struggling with mental illness and chemical dependency. So that complicates our communication with them. A lot of that leads to homelessness. So they don't have a stable phone number, they don't have a stable email, and they don't have a stable address. So we spend a large amount of time now that we're not seeing them in person and can't provide them anything in person, trying to provide them with the documents they need wherever they are. And so that's another thing that we're spending a lot more time on as a result of the pandemic. Now, certainly we've had that issue in the past before the pandemic with folks that struggle with homelessness and getting people to court. But the increase in the chemical dependence and the amount of clients with mental illness has really increased. And third, I would just like to say that recently in January, I appeared for a sentencing before Judge Awesome in the Second District. And my client had decided to resolve his case. And when he had entered his plea of guilty, we asked for him to be conditionally released to a treatment program. And six weeks later, we went to court for sentencing, and my client had complied with the probation and pre and sentence investigation. And he was able to avail himself of a dispositional departure, which allowed him to be placed on probation instead of going to prison. We were only able to do that because the dispositional advisor in my case had worked with my client to get him assessed for his chemical dependency and to find a treatment program. He was released directly to that treatment program that picked him up at the jail. All of those things take time. And that is what we do, is we try to get people out of jail, deal with their cases, and get them the help they need so they can be successful and not reoffend and be successful on probation. Judge Awesome, 3 days later, I saw him again, was peering in front of me behind and again, and he commented to me that the work that the dispositional advisor and I had done on our case was fantastic. He was happy with it. And he said that the best thing our office has ever done was hire the dispositional advisors to help us, to help our clients, and to provide that kind of client-centered representation that the attorneys can't do alone. They need the support of the dispositional advisors and investigators and legal assistants. It's very much a team approach, and he really appreciated that. Thank you for this opportunity.
Yeah, thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. O'Neill. We do have a couple more testifiers on the list, so I want to make sure we have time to get that testimony in. Brian Aldez, if you could introduce yourself for the record and then go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Brian Aldez, and I am the Secretary Treasurer and Principal Officer of Teamsters Local 320. Teamsters Local 320 is the union which represents all the state of Minnesota assistant district public defenders and the public defender support staff, totaling more than 600 employees of the public defender system. We continue to support the state public defender system and the collective bargaining agreements our union has negotiated with the State Board of Public Defense over the last 20 years. With that being said, there remain significant challenges with retention and recruitment of public defense employees. In fact, looking at the public defense seniority rosters yesterday, I noticed that nearly 40% of the public defenders and the public defender support staff have less than 5 years of service. Last fall, our union conducted a survey for all of the public defense employees that we represent, with salary equity remaining the top priority in the public defender system. Working alongside the Board of Public Defense, our union was able to negotiate wage increases across the entire pay scale for public defense employees in the last biennium, thereby shrinking some of the large pay disparities between public defense employees and state and local prosecutors. Nevertheless, those disparities remain and create incentives for public defense employees to leave service and practice law elsewhere. I want to mention that in Mr. Kier's presentation, he noted that there are some statutory challenges to increasing salaries within the public defense system. assistant district public defenders and their support staff do not face those statutory challenges when increasing salaries. And we, as we find in the comparisons that Mr. Kier offered, that there are plenty of other public law firms that have more competitive salaries. Our union supports the 10% budget increase for the Board of Public Defense over fiscal year 22 and 23. However, we do not support the continuation of exorbitant contracts for private attorneys to do public defender work that far exceeds the pay and flexibility of current assistant district public defenders. The $2.7 million for case backlogs should be added to the wages and benefits to retain and recruit current public defense employees, not to line the pockets of private attorneys. I want to thank the committee for its time, and of course I'll always take any questions, but I also want to introduce an assistant district public defender from the 4th Judicial District, Darcy Sherman, and an investigator from the 10th Judicial District, Jill Nickey, who would also like to offer some testimony. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee.
Thank you. Ms. Sherman, please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Darcy Sherman. I've been a public defender in Hennepin County for nearly 8 years. I'm a born and bred Minnesotan, originally from Moorhead, have been down here for about 20 years. And I serve in our conflicts unit, which handles a significant amount of complex litigation. I currently have and have had at least 2 murder cases set for trial at all times in the last 5 years of my practice. And just to round out a little bit of what Kevin was speaking about, my colleagues and I made a rough list of the lawyers who've left our office in about the last 7 years, and we got to 75 people. So that's 75 attorneys. 20 of them roughly retired, which is great. They were all county employees. We found that 25 attorneys went to higher paying, less stressful jobs at other offices within the state of Minnesota. We lost 3 brilliant young attorneys to the Duluth City Attorney's Office. We've lost a number of attorneys to the Hennepin County Attorney's Office. If I were to go across the street tomorrow, I would make $20,000 to $30,000 more out the gate. And we go into court every day knowing that. It's incredibly demoralizing. I could actually go from doing murders and crim sexes to doing a misdemeanor prosecution for the city of Minneapolis and make $20,000 more. And I would be done with work at 5 every day, and I wouldn't be in the jail every weekend. So this is the root of our retention issue. We have an incredibly stressful job, and it's undervalued. And I loved what you said, Chair Becker-Finn, about, you know, the budget representing our values. I think traditionally, the budget has represented the values, particularly during the Pawlenty years, where we got nothing. I think the fact that we have been undervalued traditionally is not a good reason to continue to undervalue the work that we do. We love our clients. We are the watchdogs of the entire system, and I believe that we deserve to be paid fairly for the work that we do. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Sherman. And finally, I have Jill Nitke. Jill, if you could introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony, and then we do have a couple minutes for questions from members.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Jill Nitke. I am an investigator with the 10th Judicial District Public Defender's Office. I've been doing this work for 34 years, and I also am a steward for Teamsters Local 320 as well as a trustee. I think I, encompassing everything that Mr. Kier said, Mr. Aldi said, and the other speakers, I think that what gets lost is how important we are as a cog in the criminal justice system. We're not the sexy part. We're not law enforcement. We're not Department of Corrections. We're not probation. But the wheels simply don't turn without us. You know, keeping up with technology, I'm muted. Am I muted?
You're good. Go ahead.
Okay. Keeping up with technology has been one of the biggest struggles. You know, you take a simple, what we consider a simple assault, a bar fight, and not only is there surveillance videos, but you have body cams and you have squad cams and you have witness statements, which is where I come in. The attorneys simply don't have the resources. I'm one investigator out of five for our entire district, which I believe is the second biggest district in the state. I'm one person that has to try to navigate all that technology as well as the attorney to make sure that our clients have the proper representation and we can go in there and argue intelligently with the other court staff, prosecutors, Department of Corrections, whoever it is. But again, I think what's overshadowed is this system does not work without us. We cannot retain good lawyers, or better yet, where I come from, support staff. We need to have competitive wages and be paid equitably across the board as someone in the Attorney General's office. They have whole departments of police officers that review this stuff. I'm one person that is trying to navigate this complicated system. So for them to have the BCA, law enforcement, their investigators, their administrative staff, and not be equitably paid, for the last 10 years, I had to have a part-time job to make ends meet. That's not right. That is not right. That 30-some years of dedicating this to the what I consider a calling, and to have to work 10 years extra for a part-time job because I can't make ends meet, and the only reason I quit was because my grandson was born, and I needed to spend time with him. So I think that's what gets lost in the system is many of our support staff have part-time jobs when we're already working 50 hours a week trying to keep up with the caseload. So I appreciate your time today. I just want everybody to consider how important this work is and that we are a part of the system, and it will come to a screeching halt if it wasn't for us. So thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. First, I will go to Representative Frazier.
Chair, I appreciate this presentation, and it made me think about the time that I practiced as a public defender in Henry County. The work of the dispositional officers, our investigators, dispositional advisors, and our investigators was vital to that work. You know, some of my best days were the days where I left the courtroom knowing that the work that those support staff had done had gotten my client to go home that day, back to their family, back to their job, back to providing to their community in a positive way. And much of what I'm hearing from the presentation and the budget, with it being underfunded, I have to ask the question, would society be overall in a better position if we adequately funded or properly funded our public defender's office? And to me, it seems like it would bring the cost down of our Department of Corrections if we adequately funded things, because we wouldn't have so many people incarcerated. We'd get them the services that they needed to get back to the community and back to their families, and back to being positive in the community. So that is the question that I have. We have to adequately fund our public defenders department. We have to make sure we can keep good attorneys, make sure we can keep good support staff. But until we do that, we're gonna have this cycle that we continue to have. And it's a cycle that continues to have deep disparities within our state.
Thank you, Representative Frazier, for that insightful comment. Next on the list, we'll go to Representative Long.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I want to just thank our public testifiers, in particular Ms. Nitke and Ms. Sherman, for really putting a fine point on the difficulties of the profession, and particularly the undervaluing on the pay scale that you all are experiencing, and to hear that folks. I think the 10 county graph, you know, is one perspective, but hearing in particular from some of our urban county folks who can make $20,000 by walking across the street or who have to take part-time jobs is really stark for us. And so I guess my question for Mr. Kier is, in the budget presentation, there was a request for a 1% cost of living adjustment. My understanding is that inflation next year is projected to be about 2%. And I think that's what the courts asked for in their cost of living. And for the part-time hires for meeting the backlog, I'm wondering if you had your preference, if you weren't sort of making an estimate based on our ability to fund it. And I, you know, our financial situation is rapidly evolving and we're going to have a new estimate out next week. Would you prefer to have a higher cost of living adjustment? And would you prefer to have full-time attorneys on staff who could help reduce the backlog?
Mr. Kier.
Madam Chair and Representative Long, we obviously all the time would like to have more attorneys on staff. And it's no secret, we've talked to you about it, about folks being underpaid. But the reality, again, when we were looking at putting a budget together was, you all were facing the prospect of a 9% reduction in revenue across the state budget. So, you know, we'd always like to have it. I think the graph that you saw in terms of the number of people that we need for the to bring our staffing levels to the weighted caseload level is $28 million. We would obviously would love to take it. So that's the answer. Madam Chair, I would like to address just very briefly the contract situation or the algorithm. We are asking for that one-time money. It is $60 an hour or based on $60 an hour. We actually don't pay by the hour. I think if you go back and talk to your county folks, when they are looking at hiring folks for doing civil work or for CHIPS work or whatever it might be, they're paying $100 to sometimes $125 an hour. So just wanted to, that's what that was based on.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Kier. And I will note the beautiful thing is the legislature actually decides what the revenue is for our state. The next person on the list is Representative Liebling.
Yeah, thank you very much, Madam Chair, and thank you to all the testifiers. This has been really interesting, and you know, I love the fact that we're thinking about what the state needs, not just what the numbers say right now. But what I really wanted to ask, and Representative Fraser really kind of touched on it, was what I wanted us to think about is the impact on racial justice that this discussion has. And, you know, he did kind of bring this up, but not very directly. And I just wondered if one of the testifiers, I don't know which one would be the best, maybe Mr. Kier or Mr. Ward, I see is there, just to talk about, you know, what this means for us, because we know that, you know, I'll tell you here in Olmsted County where I live, he used to say, you know, if you want to find a black man in Olmsted County, go to the jail. That's how bad it is. And so it matters. It really matters. If, you know, we know that there's been a criminalization of poverty. We know that, you know, these things stack on top of each other. So, I mean, when I hear this conversation, I can't but think that our goals to try to make this state a little more equal runs right through this discussion. At least part of it does.
Mr. Ward, do you want to take that one? Please introduce yourself and then go ahead.
Madam Chair, I'm William Ward. I'm the state public defender and Representative Liebling and members. I mean, you're spot on, right? I mean, the reality is our clients are disproportionately individuals of color. That's no secret. We've been talking about that for decades in the legislature. I mean, there's lots of ways of dealing with this discrepancy, but certainly funding us fully and maintaining our staff so we're not retraining people to do the job that we've already trained up people to do makes a big difference. I've heard that comment before about Olmsted County. That same comment can be made for Duluth, for Bemidji, for Moorhead, for Hennepin County. Without a doubt, our clients are disproportionately individuals of color. And that's something that's also noted about, you know, how we police and other things that are done and how people come into the system in the first place. My goal is to keep people from coming into the system. If they do get into the system, obviously we want to be appropriately funded to help and assist our clients in the ways that were described of being client-centered and holistic in the approach that we take to do the best possible job we can.
Thank you, Mr. Ward. And we'll go to the last question and then move on to our bills for the day. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to all the testifiers. I wanted to go back to the issue about the caseload backlog. That was dated July 30th, and you were at 10,000 felony and gross misdemeanors. I mean, do you have any projection of what it's been over the last 6 months, and when will there be an update to that number? Because I feel like we're not really budgeting for the right thing right now.
Mr. Kyer.
Madam Chair and members, we don't know. We'll get those numbers from the court, and I've asked them to provide those. I know this fall it went down some, but of course then we all went back down, went on lockdown again. And so it's really kind of ebbed and flowed, but we will definitely get those updated numbers as we move forward.
All right, thank you, Mr. Kyer, and thank you for the question, Representative Robbins. Thank you, members, for the good discussion, and thank you to all of our testifiers. I think that was really helpful as we balance what we're gonna have to do as we put our budget together. So thank you, everybody, for your testimony. With that, we will move on to the first bill on the agenda today, which is a Representative Hollins bill, House File 864. Representative Hollins, would you like to move your bill to get it in front of the committee?
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you so much. I would like to, I think I'm doing this right, move to refer House File 864 for layover for inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Representative Hollins moves 864 be recommended to be laid over for possible inclusion in a data omnibus bill. We now have the bill before us, Representative Hollins. I do believe you have an author's amendment. Would you like to move that first?
That is correct. Yes, Madam Chair.
All right. Representative Hollins moves the DE1 author's amendment to put the bill in the shape she would like. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Hollins, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Judiciary Committee members. This is an important bill that addresses the data gathered by police departments when they have a co-responder model with mental health units. As many of you probably know, police officers are often the first responders to mental health crises. And accordingly, there's been an increase in police departments that utilize mental health units to address these situations appropriately. This is actually something that we want to see happen because it means that the people who are in these crises are getting the appropriate care that they need. What this bill seeks to do is to classify as private the mental health data that's collected at these encounters. And it does that by adding a subsection to statute 13.82, the comprehensive law enforcement data. I have two testifiers with me today to give some brief remarks. Matt Ehling, I've never said his last name, so I'm sorry, Matt, if I did that wrong, from the Minnesota Coalition on Government Information. He will give a brief background on the language that was worked on, and then I would like the committee to hear from Captain Randy McAllister from the Cottage Grove Police Department. And he also helped work on the language, but he's also here to provide a firsthand understanding of, you know, how this issue really impacts police departments and the work that they're doing. So with that, thank you, Madam Chair, and love to hear from the testifiers.
All right, thank you. Mr. Ehling, if you want to introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Matt Ehling, Minnesota Coalition on Government Information. I would like to extend thanks to Representative Hollins and Mueller, as well as the multiple folks who were involved in reviewing this proposal, including the Data Practices Office and Captain McAllister as well. And we appreciate their time and attention to the public data aspects involved in this discussion. I want to briefly explain the mechanics of how this amendment works and talk about its overall purpose. So under the Data Practices Act, The treatment of data is often specific to the purpose for which it's collected, or specific to the institution that collects and creates it. And historically, the functions of police departments have been distinct from those of social service and mental health agencies, and accordingly, their data has been classified differently under Minnesota law. So police departments have specific data classifications that apply to their incident and arrest reports, as well as to the data they collect to investigate the commission of a crime. And that's called criminal investigative data under Minnesota Statute 1382. Police incident and arrest reports have specific classifications that ensure that certain facts about police activities, including narrative descriptions of events that are encountered by police, are classified as public at all times in the interest of government transparency. And this classification scheme has been part of Minnesota law since the early 1980s. At the same time, and for almost as long, mental health data gathered by social service and mental health workers has been classified as private data under Minnesota Statutes 1346. And so over the course of time, police departments have gathered data related to mental health in certain situations, such as when a criminal suspect has had mental illness issues that have intersected with a criminal investigation, which triggered a police response. And traditionally, that data has become criminal investigative data, or it's been reflected in police incident reports. Now, however, as some police agencies have started to proactively provide mental health coordinating services to folks they're encountering, the question has arisen about how that data is classified. It's not gathered for criminal investigation purposes or for responding to a call for service. And so there's no specific classification for it in the current law enforcement section. So in some situations, it's presumptively public. And so what this amendment aims to do is to strike a balance about how to handle the classification of that data by classifying specific pieces of mental health data gathered outside of a criminal investigation as private data, as they would be if they were gathered and maintained by a social service agency, but then treating them as law enforcement data if those data elements become relevant to criminal activity, just as they have been for over four decades. And from our perspective, it's important that the amendment specifies in lines 2.4 and 2.5 that this has no impact on the classification of the always public sections of police incident and arrest reports, since the narrative descriptions that are in those reports are really important for the public's understanding of how the police institution operates and for the public's understanding of criminal events that have transpired in their communities. Those kinds of details come out of police reports and we see them in the newspapers every day. And so ensuring access to that public data is really at the heart of why Minkoji became involved in this amendment process. To close, there's a couple of technical points I want to make, that there are citations at the top of the amendment in line 1.5 to 1.9. These have been provided for reference purposes since they relate to existing data classifications elsewhere in law. And there's a section that's referenced about sharing data that's held by providers with law enforcement and the conditions under which that can be shared and the consent required in some circumstances. So members and Madam Chair, that's the essence of why, the essence of what this amendment accomplishes. And I'd thank you for your time and I'd certainly welcome any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Ealing, for really laying out sort of the classic weighing of protecting private data versus government transparency that we will continue to discuss as we move some of these data bills. So thank you very much, Mr. Ealing. I do want to make sure we have time for our testifiers. So next I will go to Captain Randy McAllister. Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Randy McAllister. I'm a captain with the Cottage Grove Police Department and I've been doing that for almost 23 years. I was a paramedic in Minneapolis before that for about 5 years. So about 10 years ago, I really got immersed into the world of behavioral threat assessment. And I've been really working for 10 years to find better ways to deal with, especially with the mentally ill in the community. We've created a couple of proactive programs. Our goal really is to keep, if you want to distill it down to something simple and easy, it's to keep people out of jail and out of the hospital. Unfortunately, law enforcement has been put in the unenviable position of having to deal with a lot of folks who are seriously and persistently mentally ill because the system just isn't adequate. In many cases, there are, I think, probably some law changes that need to happen or some data privacy issues that prevent people from sharing information. But I created, 5 years ago, created a unit that's now called the Case Management Unit. So we are specially trained police officers who've been through the 40-hour CIT course. We're trying to get create a co-responder model by partnering more closely with our county mental health system. And what we do is we take those cases that have elements of mental illness in them. Sometimes the people are just excessive users of the 911 services. That may be how they come to our attention. Sometimes there are actual crimes of violence or just neighbors who are concerned. And so what we try to do is do long-term case management. The problem is county mental health services may also be doing management, but because of HIPAA and other rules, they can't share that with us, and they usually don't. So we don't know if somebody's in our community getting the services they're supposed to be getting, whether it was court ordered or not. And so really to prevent bad consequences, we try and manage those sometimes concurrently and in parallel with them. But unfortunately, as the prior testimony showed, the data we collect that's important for case management right now just sits in the police report, and potentially it's public data. And it could be embarrassing to the people we're dealing with, certainly contrary to good therapeutics. And so we'd like to be able to keep that nosy neighbor from getting it, who doesn't need have a real good reason to know. This bill would also allow us to maybe just move it completely out of our criminal police records, which I think would be a win. It would also help us keep cases from falling through the cracks, because case management really takes a lot of coordination, and you have to keep good records. And I think, you know, we may find we had a tragedy last week out in west of the Twin Cities, and something like that is perfect for case management and perfect for co-response police models. So I would ask for your support for this bill. It doesn't change, again, the data that we collect. It just reclassifies it when we're doing long-term case management. And I think in the long run, you know, if jurisdictions or police agencies choose to do a co-response model or a case management model like we are, this will help keep people safe and get people the help they need. Again, the goal is to get people therapy or therapeutic interventions versus jail or hospital. Thank you.
Thank you. Yep. Thank you, Captain McAllister. That was very helpful. We do have one more testifier on the list today, Rich Neumeister. If you want to introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony, and then we'll get to member questions.
I just unmuted. Can you hear me okay?
Yep. Please introduce yourself and go ahead, Rich.
All right. Madam Chair and the committee, my name is Rich Neumeister. I know some of you over the years and some I may not know, but your colleagues can easily tell you who I am. The bottom line here is that the bill before you is based on almost 20 years of when legislation was done. And I want to refer to that because it folds into my testimony. If you look at the amendment, you'll see that sections 144, 294, and 1346 are referred to. Those are provisions in law, subdivision 7 and 1346, and in 144, 294, subdivision 2, is what allows law enforcement to get access to specific mental health data about individuals. So what this proposal deals with is that data that's been collected, and more data on individuals been collected on mental health. Also to that information that, let's say, a law enforcement person may gather, and when they're talking with significant others, family members, about, let's say, someone's prescription, their treatment, or whatever it might be. But what happens here is now the data over 20 years and law enforcement's more involvement with individuals with mental health, law enforcement is gathering more and more information. And to my judgment, there's no accountability. There is questions of how protection that it can't be used for other purposes. Now, if you take a look at the language of those two statutes of 144.294 subdivision 2 or 1346 subdivision 7, you'll see that there are standards. It also says it cannot be used for other purposes. Also, it says there has to be some kind of request for it. But also, one of those provisions says the individual should be notified when the cops have it. The other provision, when it gets from the private providers, like the hospitals, the private clinics, or whatever, they don't have to be notified. So I think that's important. Secondly, as I offered and suggested in an email to Representative Hollins, there can be language such as this. Mental health data so classified under this subdivision by a law enforcement agency must not be used by the law enforcement agency for any other purpose. A law enforcement agency who obtains mental health data and is so classified under this subdivision shall inform the subject of the data that the mental health data was obtained. What it basically does, those two statutes that I worked with Ms. Abner Holden on and a couple other people in 2003 and 2004, you make clear that when law enforcement is now gathering more and more information on individuals, now it's no longer on paper files. It's in a computer database. And there's no ands, ifs, or buts about it. Information about individuals is shared in an agency and disseminated widely. That's from my experience in interacting with the legislative policy for nearly 40 years now on these kinds of issues. So my suggestion is put language like I've suggested. Number two, you put in there and somewhere that there has to be policies, procedures, and protocols and rules of how this information is handled, because it's all over the board in all the different agencies. And thirdly, I think there needs to, you know, be a little bit more of a discussion of some of the folks involved on this. The amendment as now is pretty good on public aspects of it, but it's not good on use on the guidelines of the use of this most sensitive data, of health data, about our psyches. So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's my two cents. Hey, and I'm very much obliged to do this deal. Never have done this before, so thanks. You know, on Zoom deal.
Yep. Thank you for your testimony. We do have a couple member questions. First, I will go to Representative Scott.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And, you know, I didn't offer any amendments today because I've heard through the grapevine that Representative Hollins is open to continuing to work on this just to get it right. And I fully support what the intent of this bill is. I've talked to enough law enforcement folks that tell me about just how many of their encounters are with people with mental illness. And, you know, our jails are full of them as well. So, and our prisons as well. So whatever we can do to kind of coordinate benefits for them, you know, I am fully in support. I do have the same concerns that Mr. Neumeister does, that all of this information coming into a law enforcement agency and how it's, we should be protecting that information so it can't be used against that person in the future for some other reason. And so I think his language is good, saying that it can't be used for other reasons. And I also think that having each law enforcement agency, and some of them probably already have this in place, but probably have policies and procedures for who can access this information and for what reason and how it can be used. My concern is that someone could go back, if they're just have mental health information on a person who is having a crisis moment, and 5 years later, there's some criminal investigation opened on this person, and whereas before it was never criminal, that information could be used against them without getting a warrant for that information of some sort. So those are my concerns, and I want to make sure that that the person that has the mental challenges that the law enforcement is encountering, that they're protected as well, and this information is not used against them in some way. So I just wanted to put that out there in expressing my concerns with the current language. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Scott. I see that Captain McAllister, did you want to respond to that? Captain McAllister, you can go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, there may be some confusion. As far as I know, this bill doesn't give us any more access to anybody's medical or mental health data. In fact, that nobody shares that stuff with us, whether it's a clinic or a doctor, we never get that. So all of this information would be collected. We would ask questions when we're at a call, essentially. So that's where we get this information from. Let me illustrate how this would be used. We've had cases multiple times. I had one a few years ago where we had a female who was violating an order for protection. We knew it was due to bipolar, and we couldn't get the mental health system to do anything. We couldn't get a civil commitment on her. We knew that's what she needed. And so she violated that 4 or 5 times before finally we just had to arrest her because the mental health system wasn't doing civil commitment. And I don't think the arrest is the best thing for her, but that's the only thing we were left with. And that case took, that was about a year and a half of managing her, make sure she took her meds, followed up with her appointments. But all that stuff's in the police report. We're going to ask these questions. We're going to ask, because we have to ask about mental health issues, if that's driving, maybe some criminal behavior we're looking at or something. So we're going to ask these questions. I would just rather it not have to be in a police report, or if that police report becomes public, that not everybody and their brother has to see it. So we don't get any extra medical information from anybody. Nobody gives that stuff to us because of HIPAA. So we get this from asking questions of friends, family, those kinds of things. So that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Captain McAllister. The next on the list I have Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker Finn, members, first of all, I want to thank Captain McAllister. I believe I've chatted with him a few times in the past. He understands the situation very well. Law enforcement has been dealing with the mental health issues since I got into it back in 1985. We've done everything we can. The breakdown is on the mental health side, them not helping us. So that makes it very difficult. I do have one concern on this bill, and it shows up the need for it in the situation in Buffalo last week. Some of that mental health information, the person could be dealt with in another department or with a different department, and the local department doesn't know about it. They know some things, they don't know everything. But sometimes that sharing that information, if things are happening elsewhere, could help that person get the actual proper help he needs sooner. So we don't have situations like in Buffalo. And where problems could occur in a different district, where it might be a Second Amendment issue, where he's applying for a permit to acquire a handgun from a local jurisdiction, but they do not have access to this information elsewhere. And with Minnesota HIPAA laws stronger than the federal level, we have information that doesn't get into the NICS system because of our HIPAA laws that creates more problems. So I'm a little concerned about not being able to share some of this information on certain issues, but they need to be real strict on the issues that it's shared with for certain things. So I just have concerns on that issue. Law enforcement already has policies in place on sharing any data. You violate those things, severe disciplinary issues can occur, including loss, the termination of your job. So they protect data very well. In fact, I know an employee who was terminated because of sharing information. But I like the idea. I like what Captain McAllister is doing, because law enforcement has been taking the lead on this, dealing with mental issues for decades, and it's about time that the mental health side of it actually starts working with us. So thank you, Captain McAllister.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Final comment, we'll go to Vice Chair Mueller, and then we will lay this bill over. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to thank Representative Hollins for bringing this bill and for Mr. Ealing for your work on it. And thank you also to Mr. Neumeister for testifying. You know, I have looked very carefully at the language, particularly those areas that Mr. Neumeister pointed out under subdivision, well, lines 1.5 to 1.8 here and those other provisions in the data practices bill. And as I understand that language, and as Captain McAllister has explained, it's really my understanding that no additional data is being collected by this bill. And I think that that's really important. Also just wanted to highlight what Representative Johnson just said as well about those agencies that have to maintain data already have practices in place to make sure that data that's private is not shared publicly. And I believe that comes under other statutes of the Data Practices Act. So I certainly appreciate the concerns raised today and hope that anything can be addressed with future amendments, but I really like this bill and happy you're bringing it. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Vice Chair Mueller, and thank you, members, for your comments with that. There are no additional amendments to the bill. Representative Hollins, any quick closing comments?
I just want to thank everybody for their time and perspectives, and I do understand, you know, the concerns that Mr. Neumeister's brought and that other representatives have expressed, and I'm very hopeful that we can work on some of those as well.
Right. Thank you, Representative Hollins. With that, House File 864, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. And of course, as members know, we can tweak that language if it needs to be tweaked should this come forward in the future. So thank you, Representative Hollins. With that, we will move to Representative Zhang's bill, House File 916, regarding corrections ombudsperson. Representative Zhang, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to move House File 916 for possible inclusion.
All right, thank you, Representative Zhang. I understand you also have an author's amendment, the A2 author's amendment. Would you like to move that, the A2?
Yes, I would like to move the A2 author's amendment.
All right, all those in favor of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right, the motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Zhang, please tell us about your bill as amended, or let us know if you'd like to go straight to testifiers.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and members. Some of you may remember that in 2019, the Minnesota's Ombudsman's Person for the Department of Corrections Office was reestablished after a hiatus since 2003. And the ombudsperson accepts and investigates complaints related to Minnesota corrections agencies. And when the office was recreated, we essentially used the same data practice statute language that was used in the past. And as the office has been reestablished, the department noticed several problems with the statute that have been discovered. Some of it is just updating some of the language. And some of it had to do with, sharing the data. The current statute makes complaint names public, but to effectively perform the duties of the office, the ombudsman person needs the trust of complainants and must be able to maintain confidentiality. And most of the people who file complaints are usually inmates, and they are in a very vulnerable position against those that they might be filing complaints about. So this is why the statute that governs the office says that the ombudsperson staff shall not be compelled to testify or produce evidence in any judicial or administrative proceeding. And, the National Ombudsman Standards state that complaint identity should be protected. And for these reasons, the initial House File 916 makes complaint identity private data, but we are working on this portion of it with other stakeholders as we speak. And the current statute also does not allow for data sharing to perform the duties of the office or prevent immediate harm. And this is what something that we're trying to address in this bill. And House File 916 allows the ombudsperson to share private data to perform the duties of the office and to address immediate danger to any person. And the statute also uses some outdated and unclear terms that are addressed by the bill. And in conclusion, you know, we created the Office of the Ombudsperson to help fulfill our duty to protect people who are incarcerated in our corrections facilities and improve safety for those who work with them. And I look forward to continue working on this bill with everyone. Thank you. Oh, and I also have Mark Haas from the Ombudsperson for Corrections Office to provide more information on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Zhang. Mr. Hasse, if you could introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony. And members, we did get permission to go a couple minutes over 10 o'clock, so we can get through this testimony. Mr. Hasse, please introduce yourself and go ahead.
Good morning, Chair Becker-Finn and members. My name is Mark Hasse. I'm the Ombudsperson for Corrections. Thank you for taking the time to consider this bill today. And I want to thank Representative Zhang for authoring the bill. I'm going to share a real short slide presentation here. I was appointed to this position in January of 2020. And in that time, I've been getting the office up and running. If you're interested in what we've done in the first year, our first annual report is available on our website, and I'll display the address for that later. It goes over everything that we've done in establishing the office. As Representative Zhang said, as we've developed the office, I've discovered some what I think are problems with our data practices statute, and that's what this bill is meant to address. Just a quick nomenclature note, the statutory term for my office is the Ombudsperson for Corrections, and we're using a short term in daily use that's common around the country, which is ombuds. Representative Zhang mentioned the role of the office. I just want to quick ask that, you know, as you consider this bill and the data that we're talking about, that as Representative Zhang mentioned, consider the unique aspects of this office and the data that we're talking about. Anyone can file a complaint with our office, but most of them are going to be inmates. And, you know, every aspect of their lives is literally under the control of the people that they may be complaining, the agency and the staff may be complaining against. One other thing I'd like to note that's unique about this office, you know, especially compared to data like law enforcement data, is that we don't have any enforcement authority. We can only investigate, make recommendations, and publish reports. So those that we're, you know, working with and collecting this data from, we don't have any enforcement authority over them. We can't discipline or anything like that. And I know that, you know, there are concerns about the government transparency related to this bill. I totally understand those, and I strongly agree with government transparency. And in fact, the goal of this office really is to improve the transparency and accountability of our corrections agencies. And I really think the goal of this bill is to allow us to do that in a better way. Just so you don't think that I just came up with this idea, as Representative Zhang also mentioned, there are national standards for this, and those standards from the U.S. Ombudsman Association is that the ombudsman should have the ability to keep confidential or release information related to a complaint or investigation. It balances the need to protect information with the need to disclose information as part of an investigation or a public report. And then finally, they do have a model act, which our statute does follow pretty closely. And that's to maintain confidential any matter regarding complaints and investigations, including the identities of the complainants and witnesses. And, you know, I've looked at statutes for other offices around the country. Washington State, for example, keeps identities private. Iowa, which has a state, an ombudsman's office for all of state government, identities are kept private there as well. So when you look at our statute that creates the office and gives us our authority and responsibilities, that does have a pretty strong protection that, as I think Representative Zhang mentioned, that me and my staff shall not be compelled to testify in any judicial or administrative proceeding with respect to the duties. But when you look at the current statute, it makes the client or complainant name, location, and inmate number public data. It does not allow for data sharing explicitly. And then, you know, there's some terms that we're updating. But I want to touch quickly on the public complainant name issue. You know, you might ask if this was the statute that was used from 1974 to 2003 when the office existed before, why is it a problem now? Well, the thing is, we don't know if it's a problem, if it was a problem then. There's no way to know how many people may have been discouraged from filing a complaint due to this statute. And so, you know, just because it was the law for a long time doesn't mean it was the best way to do things. And I'm, you know, looking at national standards and, you know, what seems to be the best way to fulfill the duties of our office in asking for this legislation. And then Representative Zhang mentioned the three main things that this bill tries to do or does: makes complainants identifying information private, allows for sharing of private data to do the work of the office, and if there's a case where there may be immediate danger to any person, and then it just removes and updates some terms. And that is the conclusion of my presentation, Madam Chair. Thank you again, and I'll be here for questions.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Hasi. I will note that there was an A3 amendment. I know Representative Zhang's been working hard, you know, working with all the stakeholders to try to figure out a way to get this language in the best shape we can get it. So we'll just, we won't discuss the A3 at this point or move it, but just so members are aware, they can take a look at that amendment to show sort of where we're at. I do have two other testifiers. I will ask that you keep your testimony brief, keeping in mind that, you know, we aren't going to be passing this out of committee today. We're just going to be laying it over and continuing to work on it, but did want to bring this this issue forward for folks to be aware of. So with that, I will go to Matt Ealing.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Matt Ealing, Minnesota Coalition on Government Information. I'll be very brief. We appreciate that there's been an open door to Representative Zhang and Ombuds Hasi to discuss our concerns about the reclassification of public data into private data. So, you know, we are certainly open to discussing this with them further. Hope to continue that talk. You know, our board has some concerns about taking what is now a very limited set of public data in a universe of data that's already pretty restricted and taking that away. So we feel there's some value in having the complainant name public, for instance, particularly for the press, who can identify who these folks are and correspond with them if they wish to raise concerns outside of the system. So we're certainly looking forward to further discussions on this and appreciate the time to testify. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Ealing. And then next, Mr. Neumeister.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rich Neumeister. So some of the items have already been talked about. I do want to be able to say that historically, I've worked with Mr. Pupar, Patricia Soline. These are former Ombuds people over the years. And they all were aware that the name of the individual is of a public of the complainant. I did get a hold of Patricia Soline, who was a former Ombuds person in the 90s, and she indicated to the best of her recollection, these are her words, the best of her recollection, and she said, I could say this,
that there was not an issue that, to her best of recollection, of the issue of the name being public. So with that in mind, if we're going to go through alternatives, I think the A3 amendment is important as a working document to make further changes. The thing is that this is a closed system. It's not, you know, we're in 2021. It's not the Middle Ages, it's not the Dark Ages. And a lot of type of stuff of abuse, death, and harassment does happen in behind closed doors. The ombudsman, which I've lobbied for, I was part of a work group in 2007. Thank God it's resurrected again, because it can provide an efficient and a good thing that needs to be done. But who watches the ombudsperson? That's the other thing. It's not compromised. So the A3 amendment is a good working document. Some of the things, like I'll just say as an example, is that definitions have to be termed what the subject is. In the early 80s, the ombudsperson, what they did, they would put out sometimes some reports and say, yes, we had a complaint about health or medical problems. They won't get into the idea, but then there was a definition of what medical meant. So, Madam Chair, I thank the representative for being open on this, and this is a very important item.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister, and we'll go to member comments, but I'm going to ask for you guys to keep it short and focused on the issue at hand, keeping in mind that we're laying this bill over. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I will try to be brief. I appreciate both angles of this and the struggle that we continually have on the public-private thing, and it's always a delicate balance where you really have to thread the needle carefully. I just wanted to comment a little bit on something Mr. Hasse said about the best practices across the nation and different things. And just because we did it for 20 years doesn't mean it's the right thing to do. And those are all good arguments. I wanted just to point out one clarification, and that is that no other state has Chapter 13. And so that puts a different light on what we do as legislators here. And one of the reasons for keeping it public, in addition to the press being able to contact these people, is if the ombuds office is going to do an annual report, I'm assuming, and I've talked to Mr. Hasse over the weekend and the bill's author, and I certainly appreciate the conversation and hope to continue that. But one of the things that that I mentioned was that, you know, if you have a location, let's say Lino Lakes, there's 300 complaints. If we don't know the name of the people making the complaints, 250 of those complaints could have been made by one person. But it might look like Lino Lakes has a real big problem if they've got 300 complaints, but maybe there's just one person there that's all they do with their time. So I think that's another consideration. And my original reason for raising my hand was to see if the A3 was going to be offered. So Madam Chair, with that, I agree with some of the other testifiers, and I just hope to continue to work with the author and Mr. Hasse on this. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Scott. And finally, Representative Johnson, if you keep it focused, please.
Chair Becker-Finn, I have a quick question for Mr. Hasse, and then a short comment after that. Mr. Hasse, I'm just wondering, I know in the law enforcement field, when there's a complaint against an officer, it doesn't matter if it's a legitimate complaint or not. To go forward, it's got to be signed by the complainant in order to actually do the investigation. But what I'm wondering is if there's a complaint that's brought to your office, and does that complaint automatically go into the, if it's a corrections officer or one of the other staff people, does that automatically go into their personnel file?
Mr. Hasse.
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, thank you for that question. No, and I have to explain that a little bit. For both inmates and staff, we really have to defer to the processes that already are in place. So for inmates, they have a chain of command and a grievance process. And for staff, they have HR and union representation. And we have no authority over staff. You know, if we were to raise something that involves staff misconduct that already hadn't been, you know, investigated by the department, it would be up to the department to do something with that. So, you know, then they could take steps like you're talking about to, you know, make a note in the file or discipline or fire. Hope that answers your question.
Representative Johnson.
Yeah, that helps a lot, but I still have a lot of concerns on this. I understand the conception, what you're looking at. I think, I just have concerns because there's a bill out there, at least last year, I think they're pushing it again this year, where any complaint against a peace officer goes to the post board, whether it's founded or unfounded, and to look for patterns where you could have one individual doing multiple complaints, and we wouldn't see the pattern of the complaint side of it. We just see the pattern that there is complaint. So that's the concern I have.
All right. Thank you, Representative Johnson. With that, House File 916 as amended is laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. And we will move the last bill of the day. We do have a couple more minutes, so hopefully we can get this one done. It is my bill, House File 696. I will move that House File 696 be recommended to be re-referred to the Environment and Natural Resources Finance and Policy Committee. I do have an author's amendment. It is the A1 amendment. All those in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
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 Aye. Opposed? All right, the amendment is adopted, and we are on to the bill as amended. So this bill is a bill that came forward last year. I believe it was actually carried by Vice Chair Moeller last year. It's regarding data collected about minors by the Department of Natural Resources. And specifically, I got a question from a member over the weekend about why the DNR might be collecting this information. And for folks who don't know, you can get a hunting license at as young as 10 years old. And so the DNR collects this data for hunting and fishing licenses, for gun safety and snowmobile and ATV courses, as well as some of their ICANN programs. And right now, the statute does not specifically specify that data collected by the DNR about minors would be private. And so what this bill does is make that data about minors would be private, which is in line with how we treat data about minors in other areas of statute. And we do have folks from DNR on hand if members have questions. This did pass out of committee with no problems last year, and would be happy to answer any questions from members. Otherwise, we will send this on to the Environment Committee. All right. Seeing no hands, and Representative Scott, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just couldn't get to the right key at the right time. I talked to you over the weekend. Could you expound to me the definition of location data? And then also, as that, there's another phrase in there, and I don't have the bill up right now, and it would take too long to get there, but there's another phrase about online, something to do with online information. And so if you could expound, or maybe the testifiers could expound on what location data means. Do they know where these young people are at any given time? I need a definition.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Scott. It's referring to the location, like if you take your course at South St. Paul, that you took the course at South St. Paul, or when you apply for your deer license, sometimes you have to let them know what zone you're in. It would be that kind of location data. It's not any kind of like tracking GPS location type of data, but simply that you took a course at a certain state park or something like that. And then as far as your other question, they're just not that sophisticated to be able to you know, track exactly where people are in that way. It's more related to, you can apply for your licenses online now, which is different than you used to be able to. You used to have to go into a center and apply for a license, and now a lot of that is available to be done online. So it's sort of just updating to where we are right now. Does that answer your question, Representative Scott?
Yeah, I think it was had to do with online access. That was the phraseology. I was just looking the bill up really quickly while you were speaking, and it's online 2.2, online account access information. And then data.
Yeah, that's actually.
Okay.
Yep. So I think that that has to do with whether you applied for it online or whether you applied for it in person, because right now there's a specific identifier when you start your online account, and then that online account is your account that's matched up with the person.
All right, thank you.
Yep, thank you, Representative Scott. Final question, Representative Johnson, and then we'll get to the vote.
I just, thinking back to when I first got my Social Security card back in the long time ago, and on it said, this card cannot be used for identification purposes. And I've always stuck with that. And whenever somebody needed my Social Security number for identification purposes, I refused to give it. I'm disappointed that DNR has been using the Social Security number, because we have a lot big issue with those being misused by people that, and I actually, I know a person who I had a Social Security number used by multiple people that really changed his situation with that funding. So I see the need that we have to keep it confidential and private, but I'm disappointed that they were even using that number, because it's a serious issue, and if they lack the controls on it, it even makes it worse.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. I can tell you from my own experience, you have the option of using Social Security number or your driver's license number. So I believe there are options out there for folks. And with that, we will get
Madam
to
Chair,
the, nope, we're going to get to the vote, Representative
Johnson. I want one quick comment on that, because children under six don't have driver's license number.
Representative Johnson, you can't just speak over the chair. That's not how this works. Ms. Borgerding, please go forward with the roll call on House File 696 as amended.
Chair Becker-Finn.
Aye.
Representative Mueller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Aye.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Frazier.
Aye.
Representative Grossel.
Aye.
Representative Hurd.
Aye.
Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Liebling?
Aye.
Representative Long? Representative Mortensen?
Aye.
Representative Novotny?
Aye.
Representative Farr?
Aye.
Representative Robbins?
Aye.
Representative Vang?
Aye.
Representative Zhang?
Aye.
And Representative Long? Well, I have 16 ayes and one abstention, possibly.
Yep. Thank you, Ms. Borgerding. With 16 ayes and zero nays, House File 696, as amended, is re-referred to the Committee on Environment and Natural Resources, Finance, and Policy. Thank you, members, for sticking with us for an additional 13 minutes. We will see you on Thursday. And with that, we are adjourned.